Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we talk economics and electoral politics with one of America's most quoted political bloggers, Matthew Iglesias. Iglesias has been a political blogger since 2002. He's also a staff writer for The Atlantic in 2007 and 8, then returned to blogging full-time at the Center for American Progress before becoming a business and economic correspondent at Slate's Money Box in 2011. While Iglesias is perceived to be liberal, conservative writer and blogger Andrew Sullivan gives out what he calls Iglesias Awards at his website for, quote, writers, politicians, columnists, and pundits who actually criticize their own side, make enemies among political allies, and generally risk something for the sake of saying what they believe, unquote. Iglesias is also the author of the 2008 book, Heads in the Sand, How the Republicans Screw Up Foreign Policy and Foreign Policy Screws Up the Democrats, and this year's The Rent is Too Damn High, on how high rents and housing costs are hollowing out communities and thwarting economic development. He'll be speaking Thursday night at a free event sponsored by the Oklahoma Policy Institute and BookSmart Tulsa, Thursday evening at 7:30 at Dilly Deli. It's free and open to the public. Matthew Iglesias is our guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Matthew Iglesias, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
We're entering the final 6 weeks of this very long presidential campaign. I just want to have you take a step back from your blogger role. As we look at the economic policies of both campaigns, there's certainly some major issues among the four candidates for president and vice president. I mean, as far, you know, the Obama administration has a record. Representative Ryan has this huge policy for changing the way Washington looks. What has struck you as the campaign has unfolded about their economic policies the candidates are talking about out on the stump?
Well, you know, one thing that's frustrating to me is that they spend a lot of time talking about Medicare, which is an issue, it's a very important issue, but it's one of the issues where I actually think they're not that far apart and are sort of exaggerating the differences they have with one another. And they're talking less than they really should about what's called the discretionary side of the budget, which is sort of everything that isn't Medicare, Social Security, and the military, where there's an enormous divergence between what the campaigns are proposing to do, but it's not something that we're hearing talked about in a really granular detail.
When we talk about the discretionary budget, I think it is a lot of money, but as far as the total amount spent in the budget, it's pretty small these days, isn't it?
It's a relatively small share. That is something the Obama administration does say. They're trying to combat the impression that they're sort of big government liberals. They say, well, it's the smallest share of the economy that it's been since the Eisenhower years, which is true. At the same time, the budget that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan have put forward would shrink it to a really tiny amount, something like 3% of the economy. And this is, you know, to be clear to listeners, this is sort of the grab bag for all the little things that the government does. It's, you know, it's the federal courts, it's the police agencies, it's the money they give to roads, it's the money they give to schools. So no one of the discretionary programs is very large, but in the aggregate, you know, it's a big deal for the country.
And cutting that down to 3%, what would that make government look like?
Well, you know, I mean, it's really difficult to say, and one of my frustrations with it is that Romney and Ryan haven't really tried to explain what they think it's going to look like. The most plausible assumption is really just that a lot of these things that the federal government is involved with won't happen, and instead, you know, states and cities will be on their own in terms of funding infrastructure, funding education, maybe even funding basic medical research. And then we don't really know how that's going to work. I mean, as we know, most state governments during the recession have had to cut back very severely and or raise taxes because it's difficult for states to manage recessions. So it seems to me that that might be extremely problematic. You know, you would have sort of all work on road maintenance maybe need to collapse if there's a broader economic downturn. But it's really difficult to know exactly what the Republicans have in mind because they haven't spoken about it.
Well, that's the interesting thing is as states are coming out of the recession, I think more of them are looking to the federal government for investments in infrastructure and as a way to sort of build demand. I think this is the big thing that we haven't heard either campaign really talk about. And as far as the recession is this has been about the absence of demand.
Right. I mean, exactly. And, you know, the Obama administration did put forward a proposal that they called the American Jobs Act that had a number of components. One of it was more federal money for infrastructure. Congress didn't want to pass it. You know, Republicans are running the Congress. They're against sort of more spending. I thought it was interesting that Obama hasn't talked about that bill more. It wasn't mentioned at the Democratic convention. It's not part of his standard stump speech. My understanding is that they don't like to be seen as complaining about Republicans not passing things that they've proposed. But at the same time, it means that if you listen to the president talk, you don't get a sense of, well, what are his ideas for sparking things? Because he has ideas, or at least he has had them in the past, but he doesn't really discuss them because he doesn't like to emphasize the extent to which, you know, he can't actually enact some of the legislative measures he favors.
And that has been interesting because, you know, when you look at the first stimulus, the stimulus from a liberal perspective, it was watered down by tax cuts, and it wasn't big enough by most economists' sense. And it would seem like he would talk about that sort of heels digging in for his proposals. I guess that sort of speaks to the large divide between conservatives and liberals in Washington.
Right. I mean, it absolutely does. There is a very profound sort of disagreement about the basic question of government spending, where conservatives feel that, at least at the margin, the spending is so valueless or harmful even, that, you know, even in a severe recession, even when government borrowing costs are really low, they want to block things. There's also a lot of partisan gamesmanship. I mean, there was a lot of reporting when the stimulus was happening that simply, you know, Republicans did not want to be seen as voting for a signature Obama administration initiative. Mitch McConnell said that he saw his job as Senate Minority Leader as making Obama a one-term president. And that has really hamstrung the administration from the get-go. It's been a huge factor in politics in Washington, and it's really trickled down all across the country to realities on the ground, to state budget issues, to local budget issues. But it hasn't really been squarely on the table in the presidential campaign, again, because the White House doesn't want to seem weak and whiny, and they've taken criticism from that. And, of course, the Republicans don't want to say, well, we've been obstructing the president too much. That's not in their interest either.
Well, I don't think they'd mind saying they obstruct the president, but they don't want to be seen as obstructing the rebound of the economy.
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, they need to say that on the one hand, you know, they're resisting everything the president is proposing to do. On the other hand, that they want recovery. You need to tell a story about the president being so misguided that, you know, he doesn't actually want the economy to recover or something like that. It's a little difficult to parse exactly how it's supposed to work. But, you know, it really is remarkable to me the extent to which the ongoing recession, the ongoing shortfall of demand, and the ongoing high unemployment have receded from view a little bit as the candidates talk much more about their long-term visions.
And those long-term visions are as different as night and day, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they really are, particularly on taxes. I think taxes have more and more come to be sort of the organizing principle of American politics. Democrats are proposing taxes to be made substantially higher than they are now, with the overwhelming preponderance of that coming from the highest income people, from families with over $200,000 in income. Republicans really, truly believe in their guts that it's morally wrong to take that money from the most prosperous people, and that it would be very economically harmful to ask them to pay more, that it would sort of ruin their incentives, distort the economy. And it's a pretty profound difference. And time and again, you know, you've had these efforts at some kind of grand bargain, some kind of effort to have people come together, but there's really no splitting the difference on this. I mean, Democrats feel that given growing income inequality, that the rich are undertaxed, and Republicans feel that given that we already have a progressive rate structure, they're overtaxed.
It's just interesting that when you look at historical tax rates, they're as low as they've ever been.
They're very low right now, and that's because we've had the extension of the Bush tax cuts. We've had some new tax cuts related to the stimulus, but that's all set to expire at the end of this year. So it's a really big deal. I mean, if Obama is reelected, the default is for those Bush tax cuts to expire. And so people are going to be paying more. If the Republicans win, they're going to extend it all. It's a little bit interesting because this tax dispute is very vicious, it's very furious, it's very profound. But we haven't yet seen the impact in the real world because Bush-era policies have continued.
I want to ask you about a blog post you wrote, last week. You know, Mitt Romney released his 2011 taxes last week. I think he paid about 14%, and that was somewhat inflated because he didn't deduct his charitable deductions, as pundits pointed out. But you had an interesting post about, you know, that was probably the right Right. And your point, your larger point was we should tax dividends and capital gains at a lower rate. Now, you are, for good or ill, usually considered a liberal economist. I don't know whether you wear that proudly or not, but that sort of goes against the grain of what most liberal economists are saying, that we should be. I mean, this is one of the big contributors to income inequality.
It does contribute to that, and it does sort of go against the grain of Democratic Party politics. But I also think that if you look at American history, we've always had some tax preferences for savings and investment. We had it in the Roosevelt administration. We had it under Harry Truman. And if you look internationally, if you care to look at France or Sweden or whichever kind of, European big government welfare state you care to, they always do this. And the reason is that it's important to not discourage investment in your country, that in the long term, it's by building buildings, building offices, building factories, building railroads, building what have you, that you get sort of richer over the long term. And it's important for the tax code to not do too much to discourage that.
Well, it's interesting. I just had Bartlett and Steele on. Their latest book is looking at this income inequality. And mm-hmm. and they were talking about the 1950s when you had capital gains rates of 70%. And now we're looking at 15%, maybe moving a little higher. It seems like that, certainly in the 1950s, now granted this was in the post-war period, the hugest boom we've ever had, but that didn't discourage investment in that particular time period.
Well, I think it's actually a little bit different from what you're saying, that the overall income tax rate was much, much higher in the 50s. It was up to 70 or it was up to 90%, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the capital gains tax rate was much higher than it is now. But the gap between the capital gains rate and the ordinary income rate was quite large then, because the ordinary rate was very high. It was up in the 90s.
So it was still encouraging investment.
Exactly. And so, I'm not someone who says, you need to have low taxes all the time, but that kind of differential, people look at Mitt Romney and they say, wait a minute, this guy's a multimillionaire. Why is he paying at a lower tax rate than like a lawyer or a doctor? And the reason is that we've always had that gap. Right, some kind of gap, even as the rates have gotten lower. And that's in order to encourage that kind of investment. Now, actually, one problem that we had back then is that the gap was so big that people were encouraged to spend a lot of time on sort of funny business, trying to disguise their real income as capital gains to get lower rates. So that's always a concern.
Gosh, that's still going on today, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. You have a sort of different kind of funny business. But, it is true. If you look up the economics literature, there's not a lot of consideration of tax avoidance and tax evasion schemes. So in a kind of pure frictionless galaxy, you often hear people say, well, there shouldn't be any taxes on capital gains at all. In the real world, if you don't have some taxes on this kind of thing, people are going to hide their money.
I want to talk about another issue that was in the news recently, of course, Romney's comments about, 47% of the electorate and this idea of the tipping point between those who do not and those who do pay federal income taxes. Now, as everyone points out, nearly everybody pays payroll taxes of some sort or some form of taxes, but mm-hmm. the income tax is what we're talking about. You had a blog post really that says, hey, that tipping point has already happened. And anything that looks at maybe making the tax system more regressive and less progressive actually moves that figure even worse.
Right. And, it's important to understand this thing about the 47%, right, that a lot of this is about life cycle issues. Your grandparents are probably not paying income tax because they're retired. You don't have a job, you don't have much income, you don't pay a lot of taxes. That's fine. It doesn't mean you weren't paying taxes when you were working. By the same token, college students very rarely pay federal income taxes, and that's because when they're working, they're usually working part-time. They're trying to get some money so that they can pay their tuition, have some spending money. But that doesn't, again, it doesn't mean that they're somehow freeloaders. They're 19, and when they're 30, they're going to be working full time. They're going to be paying taxes. So this whole vision of a tipping point, it's something that you know, it's nice to kind of dramatize the election and just say to the big donors, you know, I've got to win this one or else America is going to plunge over the cliff and become some socialist nightmare. But there's absolutely no reason to think it's true. It's just something that's kind of gotten into conservatives' head. It's been on a lot of conservative talk radio shows, but it doesn't make any kind of sense.
Is it more a demographic, you know, we had a mini baby boom about 10, 15 years ago. That millennial generation is now college age. Certainly the baby boomers are retiring. Is it just simple demographics that you have fewer people working on the old end and people not yet working on the young end?
I mean, I think that's right. You know, if you want to completely ignore taxes and you just want to get super literal about this whole idea of makers versus takers, you know, you ask yourself, well, who's making? And it's adults who aren't yet retired. You know, we're working. I'm working. You're working. People are driving to work this morning. And they're making things. Then at the other hand, you have children. You have students. So you have retirees. And they are, you know, they're living. They're still eating food. They're still taking up space in houses. They're maybe driving cars. They're using toaster ovens. But they're not working. And that's fine. I mean, that's what we want, right? I mean, we don't want 11-year-olds, you know, toiling in factories like you might have had in the 1800s. And, you know, we don't want people who are in their 70s, 80s, 90s somehow needing to work to survive. I mean, we have these programs for a reason. You know, not every program has a good reason behind it, but there's a basic reason why we have federal retirement programs. And it's because you're talking about people who, A, deserve to take a break at the end of decades of working hard, and people who don't have a ton of value in the labor market. You know, even if you were to try to put them out there, I mean, people have vision problems, other kinds of physical problems. People don't have the most up-to-date skills. So there's no real problem here.
My guest today is Matthew Iglesias. He is a business and economics correspondent for Slate Magazine. He writes the Money Box blog for them. He's author of Heads in the Sand, and his most recent book, The Rent is Too Damn High. He'll be speaking Thursday night at a free event sponsored by BookSmart Tulsa and the Oklahoma Policy Institute, Thursday at 7:30 at Dilly Deli. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Earlier, you were talking about Congress, and you write a lot about the Congress's inability and really the gamesmanship that's involved that really keeps them from getting anything done. You had a great blog post, and it really skewered both sides. Mm-hmm. It had to do with high knowledge visa
right.
extensions for, you know, high-tech workers. The tech industry really needs this because there is not enough supply of these high-value employees. They want to increase the visas. And you sort of lay this out, and it's just, you know, it didn't matter right now, the Republicans in the majority, and they wrote a bill that they could overwhelmingly vote for but would fail.
Right, exactly. You know, the issue here is lots of people say, we look at it, we say one of the real strengths of America is that people from all over the world want to come to our colleges and universities. You know, you look at any college campus in the United States and you see there's some foreign people there. You look at any graduate program, you see even more foreign-born people. And people say, well, why don't we take advantage of this enormous resource? I mean, we need more engineers. We need more technical specialists. Let's take the people who've come here, who've already cleared the security checks, who are getting these degrees, why don't we say, hey, stay here and get a job if you want? And the reason we don't is that the politics keeps blocking it. That the Republicans, you know, they put this down because they're for it. And so they said, okay, we're gonna let in more engineers, but we're going to do it by taking visas away from the kind of people who get it under the current lottery system. And so Democrats don't like that idea. And so it ginned up some Democratic opposition. And then the Republicans did one better, and they picked a special circumstance in which they needed a two-thirds vote in the House of Representatives rather than just a majority, and they couldn't get the two-thirds. But they weren't sad about not getting the two-thirds. They wanted the bill to fail because they want to align the technology industry with them. They want to make it so that the Democrats are blocking it, and they're for it. Now, earlier, when the Democrats were in power, they did the exact reverse, and they said, hey, we're for handing out more visas to high-skill workers, to foreign engineers. But they attached it to the Democrats' idea of creating an amnesty program for people who've come here illegally from Latin America. So that's something that Republicans hate, and they were against. And then Democrats got to say to the tech companies, hey, you know, we're on your side. We're trying to get your engineers. We're trying to reform immigration. And so consequently, even though the parties don't really disagree about this one thing, they still can't get it done.
How much does those sort of power decisions of, you know, affect the average vote in which there's not a partisan disagreement?
Well, you know, I do think that it happens a lot, that we've seen a dynamic where the parties are more and more looking as parties at the next election. Now, of course, politicians have always cared about elections, but they didn't used to have this level of loyalty to the party as such. They would think more about their own reelection. You know, what do people in my district want? What do my campaign contributors want? And now they're spending more and more time thinking, you know, how am I going to get my friends reelected? How am I going to help challengers in my same party? And there's less partnership, and it makes it much more difficult to get things done because, you know, on the one hand, you need to get some people from the other party to vote for your bill to pass it. But working together makes it much harder to sort of stab the other guy in the back when it comes time for election season. But we're set up institutionally in the United States that it's very difficult to pass bills on a pure partisan basis. So everyone says, you know, I just want my co-partisans to win the election. I'm going to try to help them do that. But then you can't govern that way. So we have more and more paralysis. I think this current Congress, the 112th Congress, has passed the fewest bills of any Congress in decades. And it's not a coincidence.
My guest today is Matthew Iglesias, a business and economics correspondent for Slate magazine. He writes the Money Box blog. And he's the author. His latest book is The Rent is Too Damn High. Now, what is The Rent is Too Damn High about?
This is about housing policy, you know, primarily in our major coastal cities, in situation that you have in California, that you have in the Northeast where I live, also to some extent, though, in downtown areas that are revitalizing all across the country. And it's a dynamic where there's very severe restrictions on what it is that you're allowed to build, and consequently, houses become very, very expensive, and it's not possible for people to migrate to the places where the greatest economic opportunities are. And there's a contrast that, you know, a lot of places more in the Sun Belt, generally in the South, that have, I think, a sounder policy in this regard that encourages population growth and encourages home construction. But oftentimes the local economies there are not as strong as they might be, so that we had an enormous quantity of people during the aughts moving to the Phoenix area and moving to the Las Vegas area. And they were moving there for cheap housing or to work in the construction industry. But it was sort of a house of cards, right? You had all this population growth in Las Vegas, but you didn't have a concomitant growth in any kind of industries there. You know, there's casinos, but we didn't have a casino boom. And gambling doesn't become more profitable over time. You know, it's kind of the same thing. And eventually, it was kind of like Wile E. Coyote, you know, running off the cliff, right, where people were moving to these towns in order to work in the home construction industry. But then you look around, and you're like, what? There's no more people here. And it all goes into a huge collapse. And what we really need is to be producing housing in the places where there's real employment prospects for people, you know, where there's high-tech industries, where there's biomedical industries, so on and so forth.
And you make a case for affordable housing, which in all those scenarios you talk about, what happens is housing prices increase. Downtowns gentrify, neighborhoods surrounding downtown gentrify. They push out poor residents for higher income residents. And we certainly, you know, even though we have this housing glut, we have a lack of affordable, good affordable housing for,
right, exactly,
for the poor.
You know, I mean, because people talk about housing gluts, but it can be a bit of a misnomer. I mean, a house needs to be someplace that works, right? I mean, it's no good to say, well, we have a lot of vacant houses in the desert somewhere. You know, that doesn't help people unless there's jobs there. And particularly if you look at affordability that takes transportation costs into account, if the only way to get a house that you can afford is to live very, very far away from employment centers, then you're looking at enormous gasoline burdens. You know, and that starts to undermine it. And I know that that's become a problem in a lot of places, even where superficially the housing may seem affordable, that the transportation costs that come along with the housing really kind of punish people. There was a great study of this in the Chicago area that looked in sort of in real detail about where people had been moving to get mortgages and how much they then had to spend to get to work. And that's to say nothing of the time cost. I mean, obviously, if you're spending 45 minutes of your day just driving to the office, you know, that's sort of a real burden on you and your family.
I want to ask you about one more question. This will have to do with putting your prognosticator hat on. You know, at the beginning of 2013, whether we have a new incoming Republican administration or a continuing Democratic administration, and who knows how Congress will be composed, We have this big looming issue of sequestration as a part of the debt ceiling compromise. You know, they had the super committee to come up with cuts and perhaps tax increases to lower the deficit, and no agreement came about. So automatic spending cuts of what, a $500 billion for the military?
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at some major changes, which could send the sort of slow recovery back into recession with major cuts like that. What do you think is going to happen after the election?
You know, it is very difficult to know, and it has a lot to do with how the election itself works out. If Democrats sweep everything and run the whole show, they will kind of smooth these cuts out and replace them with tax measures and mitigate the impact. If Republicans win everything, they will probably just not do the defense side of it and let the rest happen. But most likely there's going to be some kind of partisan split, that Republicans will be in the House, that Obama will still be in office as president, and then we might really do it. You know, these cutbacks may just come. You will see a lot of layoffs in some of the factories producing defense equipment. You will see huge reductions in healthcare capacity, which has been sort of a strong area of the economy. And I don't think it's going to be a catastrophe or necessarily put us back into recession, but it's going to hurt. You know, people are going to lose their jobs, and they're going to lose jobs for no real reason. There's no reason to implement these cuts of substance. It was Congress is sort of playing a bluffing game with itself. And they said, you know, how can we come up with something that would be ridiculous to do and then say that's going to happen unless we reach a compromise on the long-term budget? And it didn't work as a bluffing strategy because, of course, you know, the money – it's not like the members of Congress are the ones who are personally going to suffer when this happens. So it's a strange kind of bluff. I mean, I've heard it compared to sort of threatening to blow your own head off as a as a bargaining tactic. But it really isn't like that. I mean, it's not members of Congress. It's like they're threatening to blow my head off, you know, because they just, they like me and they'll feel sad if I suffer. So I don't think it's been a very sound approach from the beginning, and I hope, I mean, I wrote a column saying, you know, I hope they can just get together after the election and say, you know what, like, this was a dumb idea, let's just cancel it. But realistically, they're going to have to try to cooperate across party lines, but as we've been saying, I mean, that's difficult in today's dynamic.
You know, Congress, you know, the bluffing game in Congress is an old, old game. What I've noticed is, not sure if some sides are actually playing a bluffing game. When we saw the debt ceiling, I mean, this has been a no-brainer in American politics for a long time. The protests against the debt ceiling were symbolic, and all of a sudden they became substantive in the last round. And it seems like Congress is not able to play the bluffing game as it used to.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like people have gotten more and more invested in the idea that, you know, the only way to win is to seem as crazy as possible, right? I mean, it's like those old games of chicken where if I want you to swerve the car away, I need to convince you that I don't care and I'm totally willing to crash the cars. And as people have seen that, it's become more and more effective to sort of dig your heels in, to pre-commit. It was a big strength of John Boehner's hand in these negotiations that some of the new Tea Party members were perceived of as totally nuts. But at some point, you know, you cross the line from people who seem nuts to people who are nuts, and it's difficult to know the difference because the whole strategy is around making yourself have the image of being as unreasonable as possible.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. We look forward to your conversation here in Tulsa. Matthew Iglesias, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Matthew Iglesias is a blogger for Slate Magazine, the author of The Rent is Too Damn High. He'll be speaking Thursday night at a free event sponsored by Booksmart Tulsa and the Oklahoma Policy Institute, Thursday evening at 7:30 at Dilly Deli. If you'd like to read more of his writings, you can visit him online at slate.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.